When the wolf growls at the door, him solid, him steady, him true down to the core. And I will all...
Good morning, welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning. He is scheduled to be out. Do not worry about him. We'll let you know if you need to worry, and he should be back tomorrow. You can email the panel. Panel@wamc.org. Join the conversation as you wish. Did I say my name?
No.
Okay, I'm Sarah LaDuke, and for Joe Donahue this morning.
Even if you did, you can say it again.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, goodness gracious. Here we go. It's a new week. It is Veterans Day, and I am joined by preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Hello, Terry. How are you?
I'm holding up. Just want to take the opportunity to thank our veterans for their service on this day, and thanks for having me here.
We don't have any veterans on today, do we? No. Mm-mm. All of the men in my family have served, but I did not follow in their footsteps. I'm also joined this morning by senior fellow Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Nice to be here. And yeah, two of our roundtable panelists, Fred Hoff,
yes,
and Malia Dumont, are veterans. And there may be more, too, but I know those two specifically.
Yes, Bob Griffin. And also joining us this morning, our Monday regular political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post. Hi, Libby. How are you holding up?
I'm fine.
That's what you keep saying. And it's true. You're telling the truth.
I'm telling the truth. You just got to move on. And, you know, it's like, and I want to thank all the vets out there, too.
Of course.
The veterans, not the veterinarians. I can thank them.
Other point. But today,
right,
for the veterans.
And my dad served in World War II, and so did both of his brothers. Yeah. So, you know, we've got some. My brothers didn't have to serve. My older brother was too old.
Yeah.
And my the younger of the two was like 300 and something in the draft. So
okay.
Never got called.
Yeah, I think all the men in my family on my dad's side and three of my four brothers joined by choice, right out of high school.
Wow.
Yeah. Panel again at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Thank you for your service, everyone out there listening. And, you know, feel free to go ahead, Libby.
And yesterday was, I think, the 249th birthday of the Marine Corps.
Of the U.S. Marine Corps.
Right?
Yes.
Right. And our incoming district attorney is a vet. Lee Kinlan. He served in Fallujah, and he was just... promoted to be colonel.
Right, he's
in
still
the U.S. Marine Corps
reserves.
Yeah. He's in the JAG Corps. So,
panel@wamc.org. Thank you to all of our veterans for their service. We appreciate you. Of course, we wouldn't be anywhere without those fighting for our rights and freedoms. Let us go now to breaking news last evening. Covered a lot this morning. President-elect Donald Trump has picked House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik of New York's 21st District to be his next ambassador to the United Nations. The New York Congresswoman, the fourth-ranking House Republican, has been a strong ally of the president-elect and a major fundraiser for the GOP. This coverage from Politico and CNN. CNN broke the story. Stefanik was once a Trump skeptic, an occasional critic during his 2016 presidential campaign, and into the early days of his presidency, she shifted from detractor to defender, a move she explained was due in part to Trump's popularity in her upstate New York district. As Trump sought the 2024 presidential nomination, she was among a handful of potential running mates, a role for which she openly jockeyed. She also told CNN earlier this year that she is proud to be a top surrogate and would proudly serve in a future Trump administration. Trump said Saturday on social media that he will not be inviting Nikki Haley back, and then yesterday announced that he would be appointing Stefanik. This is big news, of course, for the region. There'll be a special election, probably. That's not, you know, announced, not decided, but that's typically what happens. What do we think about this? And Jim, what does the UN ambassador do? Let's like kind of set the table with that, maybe.
Yeah. So it is, obviously, it's a very important role, and it's one that's really multifaceted. Number one, you are the representative of the United States at this important international organization. So you're the public face. You're the one presenting, articulating the policy of the administration to the broader public and to all the other diplomats who are there. So beyond that, you're also negotiating behind the scenes with the other member states and the other entities that are associated with the United Nations, because it's not, there are the states, the nation states make it up, but there's other parts of the UN constellation. And this primarily takes place in the broader General Assembly, but also, very importantly, in the Security Council. So there are five nations that have veto power in the Security Council. We do, the United States, the UK, France, Russia, and China. And so those negotiations can be very intense. They're very important in many ways. You're also, just more broadly, you're gathering information. You're establishing important relationships across the UN. And the UN is obviously, it's headquartered in New York, but it operates globally. And there's many different elements that are operating all the time globally and dealing with refugees, dealing with development, dealing with women and children's issues, food issues, labor issues. So, I mean, it's a really complicated institution. So you need a really good team to be able to do that. So you're going to be drawing on people who have worked for the U.S. government for a long time, foreign service officers, people from the intelligence community, from the military, other people who are hired directly. Now, this becomes tricky if at the same time you're working for an administration that is hostile to the kind of, you know, civil servants, foreign service officers, the people who are longstanding employees of the U.S. But there's just no way to do this job, to be the UN ambassador, if you can't draw upon the expertise and the skills of a team like that. And so, you know, when you hear messages on one hand that, you know, you need to be able to do what I just said to be an effective UN ambassador, and at the same time the administration that you're representing is already signaling that they want to close down important elements of the State Department, like the Global Engagement Center that counters disinformation around the world. And I'm sure there'll be more to come. Elon Musk has already singled that out, that should be closed down, which I personally think is a huge mistake, but is, I think, a sign of much more to come. So how do you do that? Now, I think it's also, it's a political position. You're also, you know, you're a senior advisor on foreign policy issues to the president and to the administration. You're navigating the politics as well as the policy. I think it's worth remembering that Trump's first U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, used that position as a jumping off point to ultimately run against him for president.
I can't imagine Elise doing that. Well, he can't run again, so that'll be.
Right.
That's a different timeline.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean she couldn't run.
I have to say, of administrations of all different types, there have been ambassadors to the UN who have, you know, there's a real tension sometimes between UN headquarters in New York and what's going on in Washington, and they're seeking ways to kind of, you know, navigate their own way, and you want it to be in line with Washington if you're the president, but it doesn't always work out so easily.
Libby?
Well, you know, I think Elise Stefanik thinks she's going to be the first woman president. And I think it'll be very interesting to see the rhetoric that comes out of her, because on one hand, she's going to use the UN to strengthen whatever foreign policy proposals or initiatives the Trump administration wants. Like, oh, we'll just turn a blind eye to Ukraine and let Putin do whatever he wants, and we'll let and it's clear that they're going to let Israel do whatever they want as well, which I want to go on the record is, and I have said this plenty of times before, I support Israel's right to exist. I do not support this administration, and I certainly don't support what they're doing right now. But I also would like to bring to home the hostages and stop the use of rape as a weapon of war. So, you know, there's blame on both sides. But the fact of the matter is she will be a mouthpiece for this administration. She's not going to do anything that he doesn't want her to do. She has become his total lackey and yes person. And I'm sure what you will also see is the United States threatening to not pay its dues, threatening to not fund programs that they don't like. I can see them threatening to undermine the human rights part of the UN, especially going after trans people like they did in the campaign. And so you're going to see all of his domestic policies, as much as they can play out on the international stage, be played out at the UN. And honestly, as someone who did model UN as a kid, and I loved the UN when I was younger, we used to go there and all that sort of stuff. You know, I know that it's not the organization it once was. I also know it's not the organization that the founders had hoped it would be after World War II. However, it is the only international organization with any kind of ability to fashion or direct some kind of world politic and keep wars at bay and all of that. And, you know, we're seeing now that North Korea is in Ukraine. Yep. It's like the Hessians who were fighting in the Revolutionary War, right, for the British. You know, they're all going to get killed, I think. There's going to be a lot of casualties because there seems to be more casualties on the Russian side than there is on the Ukrainian side.
Throughout history.
Right, well, that's true, too. But, yeah. You know, it's going to be interesting because North Korea is a member of the UN, and how are they going to get, you know, targeted? What are they going to do? How's that? You know, are there going to be more love letters between Trump and Kim Il-jung? I'm sure there will be. So it's going to be an interesting thing to see if she does decide that she wants to negotiate or navigate, or just be a 10-pound Mack truck, you know, 10,000 pound Mack truck.
I was like, a 10 right pound Mack truck.
Yeah,
wouldn't
a 10,000 and Lego, a 10 pound Mack truck.
Sure.
But in, you know, a 10,000 pound Mack truck or 10-ton Mack truck and just go right through. And we'll see what happens.
Terry, what are your thoughts, initial reactions to this story?
Yeah. So it does strike me that at least Stefanik has built her real loyalty to Donald Trump over the last few years by really doing nothing more than screaming and yelling at people.
Mm-hmm.
She has demonstrated a real talent in intimidating people by literally screaming and yelling at them. We've seen her do that in public on numerous occasions, whether it be congressional testimony or her actions on various panels on the congressional floor. However you want to look at it, she has not demonstrated a person who has empathy. She has not demonstrated a person who is really seems outwardly anyway to be interested in developing strong, diverse relationships, which makes her, I think, a perfect fit for the Trump administration. Donald Trump, the majority of American people have voted for this person, and what we're going to see is what we already know, is that all the decisions he makes will be about him. He's not interested in the United Nations. The United Nations really has nothing to offer him. In fact, it's a blockade to many of the things that he might have in mind doing. And so if you want somebody that can go in to this vast organization and essentially work on ways to circumvent it and to even possibly blow up parts of it, then you've picked the right person. And I think he's going to be picking people like that for all the positions because he wants to surround himself with people that are extremely loyal to the level of literally kissing his ring,
mm-hmm.
To also being able to go onto the attack against anybody that would threaten him at any time. And so I think she fits that role perfectly. I think the people of upstate New York should be grateful that they're going to be rid of her and an opportunity to elect someone new.
The people of upstate New York like her, though, keep electing her. Ray writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, is Stefanik at 40, simply, I think she's 41, simply not too young and inexperienced to be U.S. ambassador to the UN? Oh. What do we think about that?
At 78, Trump is too old and inexperienced to be president. I mean, even though he was president, he's proven himself not to be able to really do the job. And it'll be interesting to see who else he surrounds himself with. It's just going to be, there's not going to be guardrails. You know, the John Kellys of the world have said, see ya. And they will be the loyal opposition. So, you know, she brought down three Ivy League presidents, right? From the hearings that she did around the anti-Semitism on campuses. She knows what she's doing. She's not a lightweight.
Yeah, but that won't be effective at the UN. So if it's purely just going to be posturing and the political aspect of it in terms of American domestic political standing, and there's simply no concern whatsoever for using the UN for in the ways that you talked about, Libby, then that will be perfect. If not, she's certainly, as I said, going to need to moderate the way that she behaves, because she can't fire the diplomats from the other countries. They're going to be there no matter what she says and screams about. And secondly, as I said before, she just couldn't do the job at all without a team around her who knows what they're doing. Because, I mean, sure, she's young, but, I mean, most of the ambassadors in this position come from a political background. Some of them come with national security experience. Some of them don't. And you have to rely on the team. So if she brings in a team of hangers-on and political types, that's also not going to be at all effective. If they don't care about being effective, okay, then it's just performative.
When the president appoints this ambassador, is there anything the UN, does the UN have any influence on them staying?
Oh, you mean, can they say she's this isn't unacceptable?
Gonna work. Yeah. No, they can't.
No. But it's an interesting point, because when other ambassadors are nominated by a president, then they have to be confirmed by the Senate, and then their credentials have to be accepted, if they're going to a country, by that country. Ah. And so there are times, it doesn't happen a lot, but there are times when a country will reject an incoming ambassador. Very rarely happens, but there's been some notorious cases when it has happened.
So this is...
Yeah, but they can't do that to her at the
no.
UN.
No,
not at the UN. No. So this is clearly a big story for the world, the country, and the region, and WAMC will continue to report on it. I know Pat Bradley is up scrambling to get information, stories, feedback, etc., to be on the news later today. We will continue, of course, to follow that story. It is time now for our first break. This is the Roundtable Panel. I'm here with Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. You can join the panel by emailing panel@wamc.org, and we will return shortly. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, here with Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and Political Consultant and Lobbyist, Libby Post. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. Jane wrote in to panel at WMC and says, "Dear Elise, not everyone in upstate New York likes you." We, of course, noted. And thank you.
Thank you so much.
She does win elections. And let's see here. Let us move on now to other movings and shakings in D.C. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer will not allow Senator-elect, this as of yesterday, Dave McCormick, a Republican from Pennsylvania, to participate in Senate orientation this week because Schumer, doesn't consider the race to be resolved yet. Though the Associated Press projected on Thursday that McCormick defeated Democrat incumbent Bob Casey in Pennsylvania's Senate race, Casey has yet to concede, claiming there are still thousands of ballots left to be counted. On Wednesday, Republican senators will vote for the next majority leader, that's this coming Wednesday, who will begin serving in January. The three frontrunners are Florida Senator Rick Scott, South Dakota Senator John Thune, and Texas Senator John Cornyn. So all these Johns, so many Johns to keep track of. There is that. When asked on Fox News who we would support for majority leader, McCormick said, "I'm still just now spending time with each of the candidates, and I will have an opportunity to vote this week." He added that he would not speak about the pros and cons of each candidate, but emphasize the need to be in step with President-elect Trump. He said President Trump, of course. Over the weekend, President-elect Donald Trump and his allies signaled that they will try to call the shots in the Republican-led Senate, pushing the candidacy of Senator Rick Scott, Florida, for GOP leader, and demanding that Republicans allow Trump to make appointments to his administration and the courts without Senate approval. Trump, who last year promised that he will be dictator from day one of his presidency, has repeatedly expressed admiration for authoritarian leaders, insisted that the next Senate Republican leader make it possible for him to fast-track nominations over any opposition. Scott vowed to fulfill Trump's request if he becomes Senate Republican leader, writing on Twitter, X, 100% agree, I will do whatever it takes to get your nominations through as quickly as possible. top Trump allies, including billionaire CEO Elon Musk and a number of far-right influencers, have quickly lined up behind Scott's bid. Rick Scott for Senate Majority Leader, Musk posted on Sunday. Let's begin with Terry. What do you think about all of this, all of these movings and goings on?
Well, first of all, on the McCormick Pennsylvania race, that's a non-story. This happens every election. The party that is about to take charge, or the party that just lost, you know, they're going to look at the numbers and they're going to hold on till the absolute last possible moment. You can't blame Schumer for wanting to hold up as long as possible. Listen, at this point, anything Democrats can do to make the Republicans' life miserable, I completely support. And if this does it, that's fine. I mean, they need to be held accountable, and we have to use whatever levers we have to do it. On the other front there, in terms of – what was the question? I'm sorry.
It's okay. This is a Senate Majority Leader, Rick Scott for Senate Majority Leader. Are we worried?
Right, Rick Scott. Yeah, Rick Scott. Yes, of course. He again, falls in line with that sort of attack dog mentality. It should not surprise anyone that has been paying the least amount of attention to Donald Trump that he has said that he wants to behave like a dictator. He's always indicated that he will do that. Everything about him points to that. And now that he's insisting that Senate leadership really do what he wants and he have absolute control over Senate leadership, it should not surprise us, but it should really terrify us. These individual states elected senators to go and represent the interests of those people in those states. So if all the people in those states care about is that they just acknowledge whatever Donald Trump wants to do and get out of the way, we're living in a pretty scary place. I think the people in those states are going to need jobs. They're going to need housing. They're going to need clean drinking water, clean air. They're going to need food. They're going to need medical care. And their senator ought to be the one out there advocating for that. And I guarantee you that Donald Trump is not looking out for the individual interests of people in these states. So it is really counter to everything that our democratic process stands for. And it's an alarming sign of things to come.
And if a Republican senator or a congressman doesn't do exactly what Trump wants, he'll go after them in the midterms and find somebody to primary him. And it's, you know, so it'll just be more of the same, and it will erode the Republican base eventually. So,
I'm just casting my mind back to Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah, right.
And how the government is supposed to function. You know, when we talk about checks and balances, it sounds like just kind of a nice theory. It's a nice thing. There's a check. There's a balance. But how does it really work? What are the mechanisms?
Oh, it doesn't. This,
well, but when it does,
right,
or when it should, this Senate confirmation process is important, even when the party that's in charge in the White House is the same party that controls the Senate. There can often be all kinds of push and pull because, as Terry said, these members of the Senate are elected from their states. Their voters, hopefully, are paying some level of attention. And so if they have to go on the record and vote yes to confirm somebody who turns out to be a disaster in one way or another, somebody who otherwise would be unacceptable, it's on them politically. So I can imagine that many of them are going to be happy to duck the responsibility of having to do this confirmation for what's undoubtedly going to be quite a cast of characters that's going to be coming through. So they'll be happy to say, like, no, we don't want to do that. But to set the stage for that to be the norm, that will be given up, means that one of the major mechanisms that makes checks and balances actually work, when it does, will be gone at least temporarily. And that's highly, highly problematic. And I think that there will be and there ought to be all kinds of pushback on it. The question is, what level of pushback will really be effective? And we'll probably have to put up with it for a while. And it's deeply concerning.
Scott, a former Florida governor who just won a second term in the Senate, has turned a two-way race to succeed Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell into a three-man contest that stands as the first test of Trump's grip on the Republican Party. Scott is running against John Thune and John Cornyn, as we mentioned, who are more aligned with the Republican establishment and are top McConnell allies and sometimes critics of Trump. So, of course, he wouldn't push for his critics to be appointed.
You also have to wonder whether how the egos are all going to play out here, and whether or not the Republicans are going to start battling with each other to be closer to Trump than you are, and all of that stuff. And these three guys, okay, so only one of them is going to win. So what are the more quote-unquote moderate Republicans going to do? How are they? Where are they going to end up? You know, it's going to be an interesting couple of months to see how it all falls out, and whether or not they're really all going to fall in line, or true to form, they're politicians and they want to be able to win, and they want to be able to, they all want to be president. I mean, that's sort of part of the deal. And whether, see how everybody ends up jockeying. It'll be really interesting to watch. Hopefully it'll be watching self-destruction, but nonetheless, it'll be interesting to watch.
One of my former professors used to say, it might be really bad for the country, but great for political science or political analysis.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. That's not a good trade-off.
We'll have jobs here at the great. Terry, any thoughts?
I wonder how long it's been since we've had this many white men be in charge of the country without any checks and balances put on them at all. So if the House goes red, knowing that the majority members of the House and the Senate are white male, and a president as well, of course, that's just a lot of testosterone being thrown around in a government, and I think it's going to get ugly, it's going to get nasty, and it is going to make for some interesting TV viewing over the next 4 years, or at least 2 years.
And don't even consider putting Elise Stefanik and some of those Republican women in the estrogen column, okay, because she is going to do exactly what he wants. She's going to act just like they are, because she sees their version of power as the only way to get power. And so it's going to be, it will be, you know, for those of us who are just keeping going, and that's what we need to do, you know, it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. It'll be pure entertainment to some degree. Yes, it'll be a spectacle. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's what I was looking for.
I would say, then speaking of testosterone and ego, we have Elon Musk.
Oh, God.
Everywhere involved in everything right now.
Yeah.
Well, in America.
And he may very well be the undoing of a lot of stuff.
Say more.
Yeah. Well, you know, he has no government experience. He's a tyrant in his own way, right? He's bought companies but hasn't founded anything. He just buys them all. You know, it's going to be interesting to see. He's going to come in there like a child. I want this.
He's already complaining about impressions of him on SNL.
Right, right. I want this. Guys. This is what it's going to be. You know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the more tenured, even the Republicans, somebody like a John Cronin, isn't going to put up with it. They're just not. And they're going to push back. And so it'll be interesting to watch.
As I said, he's already targeted this one center in the State Department that curbs disinformation. And you have to wonder, like, well, how did this come to his attention? Why is this the thing that jumped up? You can just kind of connect the dots.
Purveyor.
He was on the call with Zelensky. Be continued. This is going to get, it's weird, and it's going to get weirder.
Terry?
Everything about this is weird. it's hard. I still just having trouble grasping that it's really happening, and it's just going to get more and more bizarre. I mean, Elon Musk is a scary character, no matter how you look at it, and the fact that he has just unlimited amounts of financial resources to back him and to spread around, which is what he's doing, and to use it as leverage against people. Is scary too. He also, I'm sure we've talked about this on the show before. He has his hands in the U.S. government in a big way. He owns this Starlink satellite company, which is how much of our communication infrastructure and other countries' communication infrastructure works. I mean, he owns this thing. He can flip a switch at any time and shut it down. He's really now our space exploration program. Right now, he's it. He's the guy leading us to the future in space with his various developments. And the list goes on and on and on. He's heavily involved in all of the AI technology and development. And all that's going to continue. So he's not going to go away anytime soon. The question really is, how will the Republican Party deal with him and rein him in? He also has this electric car company, which is really kind of counter to the whole fossil fuel industry, you know, push that's going to come out of this administration. So how's that going to work? And he's just as immature and unpredictable as Donald Trump. So you can see how they get along together. But they do both have massive egos, and at some point I think those egos are going to clash in ways that are going to bring it down, and I'm not sure what that looks like.
And him flipping the switch, Terry, on Starlink is not just a theoretical issue. He's done it before. He flipped the switch off when the Ukrainians needed Starlink to do targeting of their weapons into territorial Russia, and he said, no, I don't approve of that. And so he, as a private citizen, did not allow them access to Starlink as part of that.
Yeah, see, that's, you know, things like that where the American people are really at the mercy of a corporate maniac without having any electoral say-so over these decisions is something that should really give us great alarm. And what I'm hoping our remaining elected Democratic representatives will do, and there are a lot of them, is that I'm hoping that they will stop using their airtime to fight about what happened in the election and start using their airtime to really warn the American people about what exactly is happening now and what actions need to be taken to stop it. That's really how they should be using their microphones, but they're still fighting.
Yeah.
No, we have to move on. We have to just recognize what happened. We're not happy. Okay, fine. There's a lot of work to be done. Let's get beyond this and get to work, because we have midterms in 2 years. I don't think despite what the media is saying, despite the headlines in the New York Times, I don't think that the Democratic Party is in total disarray and all of that, right? I think that there's been analysis. They have to do better on messaging to the working class, all of that sort of stuff. But we've got midterms in 2 years, and the blue wave happened in 2018 big time. And we need to make it happen again. And we have to stop arguing and fighting with each other about issues that we have no ultimate control over. And we just need to focus on electing Democrats to Congress in 2026 and to state level as well.
Yeah, Democratic Party has always specialized in the circular firing squad.
Yes, it has. There's no two ways about it. And we have to stop. We have to do whatever you do to take the magazine out of the gun.
Panel at WAM. So go ahead, Terry.
No, I was just going to say, I agree. I think right now our best defense is to have these elected representatives go out there on television and radio constantly pointing and explaining to the American people exactly what the Trump administration is doing and what the negative impacts on it are going to be, so it puts them on alert. And hopefully slows them down. And also at the same time talks about what the Democrats would like to do if they were put back in charge, and really is very clear about how we're going to help people and we're going to move forward in a sane and productive way. And that's got to be done. And this fighting about the past has got to stop.
Right.
I do need to correct that Elon Musk hasn't founded anything. He did found SpaceX.
Oh, okay, fine. He didn't buy that from somebody?
It doesn't appear to be the case.
Okay.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with email from listeners after this.
Is this the first time you've been to our little town? I said, I think it is. He said, I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning, joined by preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post. You can join the panel conversation by emailing us, panel at WAMC.org, and we do have a few letters to read here. CT writes in and says, my new favorite game is who is replaced in or quit the Trump administration today? Nobody stays. So that will be a 2025 game we can all play. John writes in and says, aren't Senate appointments, you know, part of the Constitution? Is there any way for us who oppose dictatorship and still believe in the Constitution to protest this violation and bring attention to it? Or are we doomed to be Weimar 1932 version 2.0?
I you know, it has to do with whether or not people in the Senate are actually going to uphold the Constitution. They take an oath to do it. And, you know, the problem is they do it that the way they want Trump wants it done. Somebody, the ACLU, challenges it. It goes to the Supreme Court. They've already said he can do whatever he wants. So it's going to be an interesting thing to see.
Yeah.
Terry?
I don't know about how this is written in the Constitution. I do know that the concept of recess appointments is typically reserved for when there is maybe one vote short of being able to confirm somebody in rare situations like that. I don't know how often people are confirmed during what we would consider a recess or just bypassing the Senate totally. It would be interesting to know what kind of constitutional protections there are against this.
Yeah, I mean, to bring in a whole new cabinet and other people who require Senate confirmation without giving them confirmation, I mean, that really would be unprecedented.
Panel at WAMC.org. Tom writes in, and no, sorry, Robert writes in and says, recess appointments are small potatoes compared to what's coming on the Trump agenda. I'm guessing that ending the filibuster will be one of his first demands after inauguration. What do we think about that? We'll start with you, Terry. Do we think he's trying to end the filibuster, going to try to end the filibuster?
I think that it's very possible. It's very possible. They have they're going to have the numbers that they need to pretty much do whatever they want with very little accountability being able to be leveraged against them. So it wouldn't surprise me.
You know, I mean, of course, we're in a totally different game now. But in the past, when it has been possible for one party to end the filibuster, they've been tempted to do it because they want to do certain things at that moment, but they've been reluctant to do it because they know that in 2 years, if especially with a very small majority, if they lose the majority, it could be turned around on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, you know, we're in a totally different game, so maybe everything is possible, but there has been a reluctance, even with a party in power wanting to do specific things in the past. Will that reluctance hold? Will we still hold to some level of norms? And there's also, by the way, a lot of people who, you know, really have been very critical on both sides of the aisle of the filibuster. You know, there's a whole legitimate debate about that. I'm not sure it would be done away with here in the context of that legitimate debate, but still, it's an interesting issue, and it's an interesting test to see, will the institution kind of bend to the ways of the White House or sort of dig in its heels and say, no, we want to keep this institutional prerogative?
You know, I think the filibuster is something that works for everybody and doesn't work for everybody. You know, it's one of those
exactly,
things.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I mean, oh, let's get rid of Harry Reid wanted to get rid of it, and, you know, so we could do the Supreme Court stuff and all that, all the other stuff. You know, there's now talk about making sure all of Biden's judicial appointments go through, and I don't know how the filibuster works with that, whether or not it can be invoked or not. I don't really know, but they should try to get his appointments through, but it's true. You know, some people say let's get rid of it, and then it's the tyranny of a very small minority. And some people see it as a safeguard. So we'll see what happens. It's, you know, we can all sit here and, is the right word, prognosticate, I
sure.
guess?
That's
right?
One. That's one.
And figure and try to say and lay bets on what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. We're not going to know until it all happens. We need to have some analysis and be prepared, you know, for all the different eventualities.
Right.
You know, but we just can't do the navel gazing as some of us would like to do.
Right. There's no point in exaggerating
no.
the terror until it happens.
Although I like the idea of betting on, set up a round table betting pool.
I'm not scheduling it. Running it. I'm not doing the books. I refuse categorically. Also, I don't know from numbers. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will read this letter, discuss it for a moment before we head over to a newscast. Anna says, please don't forget how Trump's policies are going to hasten our catastrophic road to extreme climate changes and environmental degradation. All things you've been discussing will be affected by the worldwide events brought on by climate change. Do you think this issue is being given enough attention? I don't. And I reply initially saying, I think, our programming tries to give it enough attention, but then globally, and on the national level, I don't know.
That is one of the things that really is makes the UN an important venue for these discussions, these specific negotiations. I mean, right now, the annual climate change conference is going on in Azerbaijan,
mm-hmm.
where I was a couple of months ago, and they were already preparing for it. And years ago, while I was in Egypt, it was there too. So it's following me. Or I'm following it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
So but, you're the key.
Yeah, exactly. As always.
Do whatever thing to make climate change stop then, Jim.
But there was just an article that I read this morning about how all of the great promises that were made at the last version of this conference, which I think was in the United Arab Emirates, haven't been followed through on at all. Beyond the press releases and all the great promises and the platitudes and everything, how do you really get down to policy negotiations to make things actually work? And the UN is supposed to be one of those places where you get into the details and hammer things out in a very specific way. Will this incoming administration really care about that? I think the letter writer probably answered her own question.
I mean, they've already talking drill, baby, drill, so...
Yep.
Yeah, and we're already drilling a lot. Yeah. I mean, the U.S. is an oil producer state, country. Yeah.
Terry, anything on climate change before a news break?
I think that it's important that all of those that are advocating for sensible policy that will help protect our planet from climate change need to be much more vocal and much more prominent and really explain what is happening and the steps we can take. Steps we can take to curb it, the steps we can take to actually improve our quality of life, and to point to how the Trump policies are working exactly counter to that, which you can be sure they will. And it's my hope that those that have the microphone and have the public's attention will take the opportunity to do that.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation this morning. Panelists are Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, and it's time now for a news break with Ray Graff.
You folks even knew his name, but a hero, yes, was he.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning, joined by preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. You can join the conversation by emailing panel at WAMC.org. Please keep your messages relatively short, on topic, and proof them real quick if you have time before you send them in, just so that they're... We can be sure to comprehend what you are trying to say, or have our best chance at comprehending what you're trying to say to us. Panel at WAMC.org. And Jim, you wanted to address something we were talking about before the break.
Yeah, just before the break, Terry mentioned, people need to stand up, that politicians need to stop, kind of having the circular firing squad about the elections on the Democratic side, and people in general need to stand up. And he said, they need to use their microphone, and I completely agree, and that's a good way to put it. But we've already heard Donald Trump say that he'd like to take that microphone away,
mm-hmm.
that he'd like to use the power of the FCC in some cases to take that microphone away. I've also seen, just in the last week, people who have weighed in on social media. Even people who I know have weighed in on social media and said certain people who are saying certain things on the air, they ought to be held accountable. Maybe they should be, you know, they should be accused of treason if they're saying the wrong thing.
Oh, God.
And, you know, I mean, number one, I don't know how informed that is of a statement. I mean, treason means you're working on behalf of a foreign adversary. Secondly, treason is punishable by death. So if somebody is saying, oh, you ought to be punished by death for saying that I don't agree with, you know, people have just been kind of unleashed. They've been given license to say such things. And it's troubling. It's dangerous. But for those people who do actually have the mechanisms of government in their hands, or they will after January 20th, including the FCC and other mechanisms, I think that's another fight that's going to have to be fought pretty early on. You said that Elon Musk was already complaining about SNL.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that's a fight that's coming up very soon, just to hold on to that microphone that Terry was talking about.
The fact that they didn't know what treason meant is all you need to know about these people.
Oh, maybe
who are
they
saying
did.
That.
Maybe that's what they,
you know, I doubt
they
it.
Want.
I doubt it. But, you know, it's very clear that these people want to come after our liberties. You know, the Supreme Court will be pushed to overturn marriage equality. They'll be pushed to do other things. We're in a world of hurt, but we can't just, you know, put our heads down and not look up and not do the work that needs to be done. We have to push against it. It's just that simple.
Terry?
Well, I am very concerned about the potential of this administration clamping down on freedom of speech and freedom in the media. I just can't quite envision how, say, a gigantic corporation like NBC could be prevented from communicating right on the air. But I know it could be done because it's been done in other countries. But it is, these corporations are huge, and these corporations are also highly invested in elections. You know, these corporations and their board members are big donors, big contributors. And that plays a role in factoring this as well. So I am fearful of it. I just am not quite sure how it would work.
They probably take away their license, which, okay, so take away the license. That doesn't mean I'm not going to broadcast, right?
Right, exactly. Because they own all this.
They own all the equipment. Right.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Right. And so, but the other thing here is that these networks and the streaming services and everything else are the conduit for capitalism in this country. It's called advertising. And so... Yeah. The people that want to continue to make money, many of whom probably voted for Trump, also want to continue to be able to advertise their products. And so it's easier to go after NPR because it gets government funding, but going after ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, the other ones, all the streaming services,
right,
it's going to be a lot more difficult to do that. And it'll be very difficult, I think, for the Supreme Court to actually rule against freedom of the press. They may do bits and pieces here, but this is a fascist takeover of our media, and it will go through the courts, and it'll be very difficult for the Supreme Court to say, "Oh, that Trump's right," because this really is the basis of our democracy, is a free and open press.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all that has been said about that. But I have also seen in other countries that are authoritarian regimes that one of the main ways that the censorship works is self-censorship, by making the situation just so uncomfortable for the entities that are putting the information out there, that they bit by bit by bit pull their punches. And there's a cumulative effect to this that is very troubling. So it doesn't happen all at once, it doesn't happen overnight, and it doesn't necessarily happen with a major edict, like you've lost your FCC license or something like that. But the threat of that, the pressure Terry was talking about, you know, the political involvement of some of the, you know, the major figures in the media, pressure on them, the possibility that they'll lose government contracts for Amazon and other things like that. You know, you start to see the self-censorship that is even more effective than the actual censorship.
Panel at go ahead, Terry. Sorry.
Well, no, I agree. That is a much more immediately likely scenario that you will see slowly but surely individual commentators that have normally been very much out on the cutting edge in terms of their ability to hold elected officials accountable by really saying things on air against Donald Trump. You'll slowly see them sort of backtrack and become silent. But I'm also really worried. I think I'm even more worried, really, about the individuals that have gained large social media followings, large Substack followings, individuals that are doing a great job and sometimes a much better job than legacy media at really communicating what's going on out there and really doing an incredible job of putting the facts and information out there and informing the public and doing it very much from a democratic perspective. I'm worried about their existence. I'm worried about them being silenced because they're not surrounded by like these giant corporate legal protection. You know, if you work for NBC or if you are NBC, just as an example, you know, you just have endless resources in terms of lawyers to defend you. An individual that has a Substack following of millions of people probably doesn't have any of that. It could easily be silenced by just having enough groups target them and make their life miserable so they felt insecure. That's what I'm really worried about, is individual Americans being silenced.
Yeah, I think that's a well-founded concern.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panelists this morning, Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. Let us go now. We brushed on this earlier, but let us speak more in depth about the North Korean troops joining the Russian troops. According to the U.S. and Ukrainian officials, the Russian military has assembled a force of 50,000 soldiers, including North Korean troops, as it prepares to begin an assault aimed at reclaiming territory seized by Ukraine in the Kursk region of Russia. This is from the New York Times. A new U.S. assessment concludes that Russia has massed the force without having to pull soldiers out of Ukraine's east, its main battlefield priority, allowing Moscow to press on multiple fronts simultaneously. Russian troops have been attacking Ukrainian positions with missile strikes and artillery fire, but they have not yet begun a major assault there. Ukrainian officials say they expect such an attack involving the North Korean troops in the coming days. For now, the North Koreans are training with Russian forces in the far western part of Kursk. The Russian-North Korean offensive looms as President-elect Donald J. Trump prepares to re-enter office with a stated goal of ending the war quickly. Mr. Trump said little about how he would settle the conflict, but Vice President-elect J.D. Vance has outlined a plan that would allow Russia to keep the territory it has seized in Ukraine. Some U.S. military and intelligence officials have grown more pessimistic about Ukraine's overall prospects, noting that Russia has steadily gained ground both in Kursk and in eastern Ukraine. Officials say the setbacks are partly a result of Ukraine's failure to solve critical shortfalls in troop strength. President Biden has been deeply supportive of Ukraine, pushing Congress to approve billions of dollars in aid, as we know, and having the U.S. military and spy agencies provide critical intelligence to help Kyiv fight the war. Jim.
The first thing I want to say is just that presidential transition periods are always very tricky and dangerous when it comes to national security and when it comes to ongoing conflicts that are going to be handed over from one administration to another. So when the George H.W. administration had to hand over the Somalia situation to the Clinton administration, it eventually led to a complete disaster, ended up in the movie and the book Black Hawk Down, and which we spoke about when Ambassador Gassendi was on the air here. And he talked about how that transition period really contributed to that. Also, the handover from Clinton to George W. Bush, and apparently, you know, many dots were not connected about 9/11 that was coming, and on and on. So just as backdrop, this is a very... it's a concerning time in general. And then you have somebody coming into power who has really stated very different viewpoint than the current president. And already we see kind of mixed signals. So we see this, you know, massive buildup of troops, 50,000 That's a serious number. And the inclusion of North Korean troops as well as Russian troops, but also reports that Donald Trump has talked to Vladimir Putin and has told him not to escalate the situation. And has he said on the campaign trail he was going to solve Ukraine in the first 24 hours. Uh-huh. What does that really mean? That probably means that Russia will get to keep a large amount of all of the territory perhaps that they've gained already. And perhaps equally important to that would probably be guarantees that Ukraine will not be joining NATO, Ukraine will not be aligned with the West in many other possible ways, that the Russian victory will be both territorial and political. And that if that were to happen, what does that mean for the future of NATO? What does it mean? I mean, Ukraine's not in NATO, but this has always been also about NATO and the standing of NATO and Europe's security. And it could well be, some are speculating, that Russia would take a breather and then test that resolve. And then Donald Trump and the administration would have to decide, would they live up to Article 5 of the NATO charter, which says that an attack on one is an attack on all. And if he doesn't, NATO is essentially over, number one. And number two, then the Europeans have to decide, are they going to fight on their own? And I recall last summer, I was in Sweden, and I just happened upon a group of Special Forces troops that were training, and I was talking to their young officer, and it's just before Sweden officially joined NATO, and we just happened to come up about NATO, and he said, you know, we see what's going on in the world. We're in this neighborhood, and he said, NATO or not, we're getting ready. We're getting ready for what we know is coming, and that's pretty serious.
And if Trump makes good on his promise of pulling out of NATO, right, because he has been threatening that all along, then it's no longer up to the United States. The rest of NATO can bring in Ukraine, and they'll all fight together. I mean, that's a scenario, too, could happen.
That's a scenario, but one that's likely to lead to a massive conflict.
Yeah,
I mean,
I know.
An actual outright war.
Yeah.
And can Europe wage that war without the United States?
Well, you know, it's going to be an interesting thing. If there is that war, and here's Mr. Capitalist, right, Trump, what's he going to say to the military-industrial complex? No, you can't, right? You can't sell arms directly. I mean, it's going to be – he's going to be caught. But the thing is, he's too stupid to really understand what's going on, and he's going to be caught – in the middle of all of this. It'll be interesting to see how they play this out. I think the scenario of taking a breather and then Putin doing whatever the hell he wants to do because Trump's going to give him the green light is probably one that will happen.
Terry?
Well, yeah, going back to my comment about people with microphones, I want to bring up that we still have a president, President Biden.
Right.
I don't think that he's been particularly strong throughout his presidency in communicating the dangers of all the various conflicts happening around the world in terms of how they impact our future. I don't think he's been very strong at that. But in terms of maybe helping build up his legacy, securing a better legacy, I know it goes against tradition, but I think this situation really calls for President Biden to use his remaining time in office to go before that microphone often and really lay out in very clear terms the importance of staying in NATO, the pros and cons of the various conflicts going around in the world, whether it be in Israel, Gaza, whether it be in Ukraine, talking about China, talking about North Korea, Russia. He needs to really go out and explain to the American people what is happening in the world and what the impact on our democracy could be if it's not handled in a certain way, and really hold the Trump administration accountable, put them on notice that the American people are watching you. And I have just now informed them that this is what you're risking. I would love to see him do that. I don't know if he's capable of doing it in a clear and succinct way, but I think it's worth a try. Otherwise, he just walks out, hands it over, And whatever happens, happens, and nothing of real substance and record has been put down to really hold him accountable before he has the keys to the White House. And that concerns me. I'd like to see that happen.
Yeah, it would be interesting if President Biden takes the opportunity on Wednesday when President-elect Trump is visiting the White House and all the cameras are on them to say, oh, we're going to talk about Ukraine while President-elect Trump is here. And here's what I'm going to say. And just lay it out. That would be a great moment. I don't know if it will happen, but that would be a great opportunity.
It doesn't do well in unscripted moments. So I would love for that to happen in the movie version, but I'm afraid it could just backfire. I think it needs to all be teleprompted out, and that would be fine. Just read it off a script. Read off a script, let it all just be written out by speechwriters, just lay out the facts. The people need to hear that. They don't need to hear it put into sort of, you know, the Biden language, which is really vague and hard to understand. They need specifics. I really hope that they will do that.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panelists this morning, Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. Let us move south in the world on the map, to discuss another major conflict. A major surge in fighting in Sudan has taken a searing toll on civilians. This from the New York Times, killing hundreds of people in aerial bombings and revenge attacks in the past week as Africa's largest war shifts into a higher gear after the end of seasonal rains. Jim, before I continue, could you tell us just sort of lay the table about this conflict, et cetera?
Yeah. The first thing I want to say is just about world attention or inattention to this conflict, and what conflicts get paid attention to and what ones don't. And I think that it's useful for us to take a kind of a hard, honest look in the mirror and say, is it because it's Africa? Is it because people don't care about Africa and Africans mm-hmm. as much as they might care about people in other parts of the world? That might be a pretty ugly conversation to have about, but I think that it's important. I'm glad we're talking about it today mm-hmm. because this war has been going on since April of 2023. It started off as two kind of rival power groups in the capital of Khartoum, and it has spread across the country. It really is happening kind of there was a longstanding dictator who left in 2019. There was some moments of optimism, some potential change, and some real kinds of advances in possible democracy in Sudan that was thwarted by a military coup in 2021. And then, this conflict starting in 2023 has led to, over 20,000 people killed. Over 8 million displaced internally, another 2 million displaced outside of the borders of Sudan into other places that are having their own challenges, like Chad and Ethiopia, South Sudan, which is a separate country. The UN High Commission for Refugees says that there's 25 million people there who are suffering immediate and profound crisis of, just food, water, healthcare, et cetera. It's also drawn in countries that are using this as proxy wars. So the United Arab Emirates are kind of squaring off against Saudi Arabia. Egypt is on the side which borders Sudan. They're on the side of that Saudi Arabia is supporting. It really has turned into, in what seems to be an intractable, a really ugly conflict. People might remember the previous conflict of Darfur in Sudan. This has also, kind of gotten that going again. And we've seen ethnic cleansing in Darfur. We've seen the weaponization of rape in Darfur. So this really is, a global crisis that I think is not getting global attention.
territory has changed hands. Excuse me. A prominent commander has switched sides, and retreating fighters have sexually assaulted, kidnapped, and killed villagers as they have moved through contested countryside, according to activists, democracy groups, and accounts on social media. A military cargo plane slammed into the desert in the western region of Darfur with at least two Russian crew members on board, offering direct evidence of the growing role of foreign contractors in the fighting in Sudan. And Sudan's military, after losing control of vast areas, has finally seemed to regain the advantage over the rapid support forces, the powerful paramilitary group that has been battling, that it has been battling for 18 months. Both sides face a barrage of war crime accusations from the United States and human rights groups, although only the RSF, which is the Rapid Support Forces, have been accused of ethnic cleansing.
And I did forget to mention that Russia, particularly the Wagner group, we've heard about before, which is essentially a mercenary group but is working on behalf of the Russian government, they're up to their eyeballs in this conflict.
You know, it's, I think that this hasn't gotten the kind of attention it should have because we've been focused on other conflicts, but also because, yes, this is Africa. These are people of color. These are people who are the other for so many. And we just don't think it's that important. But this is genocide. This is ethnic cleansing. This is the example that we need to be looking at when you talk about those concepts. This is what it is. And they certainly want to get rid of whatever side it is. They want to do ethnic cleansing. I remember when there was ethnic cleansing going on in the Balkans during Clinton's presidency. We stepped up. They're white. We're not really, nobody's stepping up here because they're black and poor and in Africa.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will continue to discuss this topic after a news break and, of course, get Terry Gibson's thoughts. Panel is preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, senior fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post. Again, you can join, you can join the conversation by emailing us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue this morning, and we will return after this.
To hitchhike from Saginaw, I've come to look for America.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc, in for Joe Donahue, joined by Terry Gibson, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. We left before the break and the newscast from the BBC talking about the conflict in Sudan, and we'd yet to hear from Terry Gibson on this matter. Terry. If you're talking, we can't hear you. You're muted, I think.
I'm really glad that Jim brought this to our attention and had it be part of our discussion this morning, because I do think that it gets very little coverage. And I just worry that, in general, the majority of American people are not as educated as we are not as educated as we should be on global conflicts and global foreign policy, and how all of that really is important to the survival of our way of life here in the United States. We take it for granted. And I just fear that we're headed into a period of really strong, violent isolationism, where the power at the top is going to continually focus on how it is unimportant that we involve ourselves in other conflicts around the world, and that we let them work out on their own, and that we are better off keeping our resources here at home. And I just think that that is such a dangerous mindset. Why is it that the horrors that are happening in Sudan are not put out there on the same sort of even platform as what's happening in Israel and Gaza, what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in all the other conflicts around the world? Why does it always get left off the list? It doesn't reflect well. It doesn't reflect well at all on the human, on the American population. And whether that is a result of how history is taught in schools, or whether that's a result of how the media tends to cover and not cover things, or whether it's politicians just ignoring it, I'm not sure, but it needs to change. And for us to really move forward, we're going to have to understand that we are part of this global village, that we're a part of everything that's happening, especially with the climate change issue. People are going to be moving. People are going to be migrating. People are already migrating to places where they can get access to clean water and access to food and housing. And that's all going to hit us in a very big way. And I just feel like we're not prepared for it. And if Donald Trump wants to just take us all into a cave and sort of take us back to 1950, we just can't allow that to happen. We've got to live in reality. And what Republicans are doing, and they're doing a very good job of it, is they create an alternative reality. They create a reality where everything is going to be okay if we just take care of what's happening here in our own backyards. And that's just not true.
Yeah. I mean, what does America First really mean when it comes to these global conflagrations? And as you said, Terry, you know, even if one were willing and able to turn their eyes away on the humanitarian stuff to say, okay, just the self-interest of the United States ought to compel people to be paying attention to these, you know, absolute meltdowns that are drawing in so many other global actors in a very, very catastrophic situation. And this is, I think, this is in the context of a broader kind of, you know, American, you know, public inattention, but also foreign policy inattention across Africa. There's a strip along the southern edge of the Sahara called the Sahel and into West Africa. The U.S. for a while was trying to ramp up its presence in both diplomatically, but also in a development way. And it's taken many steps back, even during the Biden administration. And what was largely the region of former French colonialism, and the French were there. The French have stepped back. The Americans have stepped back. Guess who has stepped in? China, the Wagner Group, the Russians. It is most definitely not in the interest of the populations that are there, but it's also not in the interest of the United States to allow this to happen.
It's what I said before. It's Africa. They're black. We don't care. I mean, it really comes down to that. And you're not going to see this new administration doing anything about it. He'd love for all these people to not be alive, let alone having to deal with them. So, you know, it's, you know, with all the other things that are going on, this has not gotten the kind of attention that it's needed. And it's been going on for a long time. And it's going to it'll destroy a country. It could very well lead to intercontinental conflict in Africa and destabilize, which is not a good thing. And you know, we've got South Africa, where people by the droves are leaving the African National Congress,
mm-hmm.
the party that was started by
Mandela.
Thank you. And so there's discontent, and we have seen, just like in the United States and other predominantly white countries, despots taking over in Africa, like we have here.
Romeo Dallaire led the UN mission to Rwanda during the genocide and wrote in Foreign Policy on Friday, "We fear that this conflict in Sudan is on the road to becoming a repeat of the 1994 Rwanda genocide." So that's obviously very stark information from someone who was there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of he's spoken about it publicly, great regrets of Bill Clinton that the United States did not do something to stop that genocide in Rwanda. And it was well known what was happening, and the world stood to the side, and it happened. So coming from that source, that should get everyone's attention.
Terry, do you have a final thought on this topic? Or have you said your piece?
I think that I have said my piece.
Okay. That's allowed. we'll allow it. Preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, was here this morning. Thank you, as always, Terry.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm sorry I didn't have some big monumental words of wisdom to leave you with today. Just,
hey, next time. Next time.
It's just not there.
I understand completely. Senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, was here. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And Veterans Day. Happy Veterans Day. And definitely honor the service.
And political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Thanks for being here, Libby.
Oh, anytime.
The panel will be posted online at WAMC.org along with all of our segments. The Congressional Corner is next on the Roundtable.